The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine. It's Friday, the 27th of January, 2023. I do hope you are well. And we've another busy show for you this Friday morning. Very shortly, introduce to you our Friday panel later on. Michael and Fionnuala will be in with us, and there's so much more besides. Involve yourself in the conversation by WhatsApp and text 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or by giving us a call on 07491 25000. Comments at highlandradio.com is your email, and don't forget, if you want to, you can watch us on your big screen on your Fire Stick Smart TV. Go to YouTube Highland Radio Ireland, or across our Facebook pages on Facebook Watch. Or it's even on our website, highlandradio.com. All right, without further ado, let's say good morning to Councillor Nicholas Cross, an independent councillor in the Inishowen Municipal District. Good morning to you, Nicholas. How are you keeping?
Good morning, listeners.
It's good to have you on board again. Maria Rush is the owner and manager of Rush Fitness and a writer also. Hi, Maria.
Good morning, guys. How are we today?
Fantastic. Great to see you. And last but certainly not least, the editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune newspaper, Mr. John McAteer. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have you with us. Okay. Quite a bit to get through. Let's start with an emerging story over the last couple of days, although it's not really emerging, but locally at least. As we all know, a debate is raging about the arrival of international protection individuals into Donegal, some arriving in Letterkenny, others in Lifford. Concerns range from conditions that they must live in to the impact their arrival might have on the general area, without going into specific details there. My understanding is Gardaí have had no issues with refugees in the Letterkenny area in recent times, but at the same time, the information they have on the new arrivals, I understand, also is somewhat limited. Now, we'd see across the country protests taking place against their arrivals. It's a mixture of concerned residents and then maybe others with their own motivations. And at the same time, then we've got the government themselves effectively saying Ireland is full, you could argue, in advising new applicants there's no space for them here. They effectively will become homeless. And a similar message was conveyed to Ukrainian refugees. So how do you read the situation, Maria, and how do we progress from here, do you think?
I think this is going to be a story that's going to continue to just circle and circle and circle and circle. And, you know, the people involved in this are coming from incredibly difficult situations. The people who are involved in the communities in which maybe large numbers are arriving into are dealing with incredibly difficult situations. There is no right or wrong answer here. I don't know how we find a medium ground. What I do see, and what I've seen in the last few hours as well online, is is a massive opposition. There's no such thing as having a moderated debate about things anymore. You're either for or against. And I think that's something that very much is evident at the minute with the situation, that there's no... Anybody who tries to speak to say, this is the reality, these are the facts, here's what's happening, if that doesn't comply with the views of others, they then become...
There's no nuance in the conversation at all, is there? It's either, you know... fling the doors wide open or pull up the drawbridge. There doesn't seem to be any space in between that for a conversation.
Yeah. And there has to be management of it as well, though, in fairness. Like, it can't be one side against the other. There has to be a conversation. And I know these conversations have been happening, but unfortunately, on the ground, we're not seeing the results of very many conversations. It seems to be that people are arriving, people are questioning things, they're not getting answers. You have the media offering different opinions. You've got one article saying, here are the facts and figures about why this is not a problem. You've got another national broadcaster or national platform on the same day with a headline about, you know, them arriving with no travel documents and the amount of funding. You've got local conversations happening. You've got the other side of that too, is the experiences of people who are dealing with and working with refugees and asylum seekers and the people who are coming into our country who have nothing but positive experiences with them. You know, they're lovely people. They're integrating well into the society.
Well, there's nothing statistically to suggest at this point that, and listen, I remember protests against Polish people coming to live and work here. I mean, if you look at the statistics, there's no statistics as such to suggest that. I mean, like, say, I understand that people would be concerned about, you know, say, for instance, the safety of women and children, but our record in relation to the protection of women and children historically hasn't been fantastic either, as if, you know, the arrival of more people is all of a sudden this immediate threat that never existed before. Now, I'm not saying people might say, yes, well, things were bad enough, do you want them even worse? But I don't know how much this is evidence-based. Then people might look to what's happened in other European countries and seen how, you know, an influx of people, how it's affected and created dynamics. You know, so there is evidence there. Dependent on what your view is, I think you can root out evidence to back it up effectively.
And that's it. And anybody can find evidence to back up whatever their opinion is on a particular day. You know, so that's, I suppose that's where I'm coming
all right,
from.
All right. John McAteer, how do we square the circle? You know, I mean, the policy is that you do not consult with people. You do not consult with local communities. And then you're firefighting because all of a sudden buses pull up in the middle of the night and people are instantly on guard as to... Because, you know, we don't like uncertainty. We don't like a lack of knowledge, John.
We were amongst the first groups in Milford to have the Ukrainians in here and... ever since that, I suppose there's been a pretty good relationship. I've not heard too many complaints. In fact, I haven't heard any complaints other than we've run a number of stories in the Tyrconnell Tribune over the recent months, and it wasn't about how the refugees were might be creating a problem. It was the fact that people close to working with them felt that there was overcrowded conditions in the places that they were staying, that there was far, far too many people in single rooms. In fact, we had complaints that on two issues that two couples had to share one space. Refugees are going to keep coming into Ireland. We're going to be very hard-pressed to deal with them. I can see the social media going absolutely mad about it. I don't understand why that is, because we've lived with the refugees since last April. And we don't see any issues or any problems with them. And we know that the more and more are going to come from talking to different sources in the past week. There's been a slowdown since prior to Christmas time. That is going to move on again. I think the situation is going to be somewhat more regulated, that the council is going to have much more of a role in the enforcement of the housing and the accommodation to try and avoid overcrowding. But the question is going to arise come Easter time, with contracts running out for 14,000 hotel beds and probably another 14,000 coming right in on top of that. We simply don't have space for them.
We'll get to that in a moment.
We can't create it automatically.
I think the concerns I'm hearing expressed are not as much about the Ukrainian refugees, which are, I think, primarily made up of women and children. It would be the busloads of international protection refugees, which seem to be primarily made up of males, and I think there's I think we can maybe differentiate between the two groups in terms of what I'm reading as a reaction, John.
I would understand that most of the refugees that we've been getting have been coming from eastern and southeastern Ukraine, and from what I can see, they get on well with the community. We're meeting them in the shops. We're meeting them on the streets in Milford, and I mean, what do we expect? People are totally displaced, thousands and thousands of miles from home. How would we feel if we were landed into the very centre of Ukraine in the middle of a war, wondering where your loved ones are? Are they alive? Are they dead? Are they going to survive the next onslaught from Putin? I haven't seen an issue with Ukrainians. I've taken lots of stories and lots of reports on them, but it was all a one-way traffic in that the concerns were coming from the voluntary groups who were helping them and looking after them. And it was in the area that there was too many of them crammed together in the one space. But then when you look at it realistically, do we have space? Do we have accommodation? Do we have schools? Schools and health centres are a very, very big issue, because you have to try and accommodate all those people within those existing infrastructures that you have, and they're not capable of managing it or handling it. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the personnel, they don't have the teachers, they don't have the extra medical doctors, they don't have the nursing staff, they don't have any of that. So it's around that that we have to try and cope with. But between direct provision and Ukrainians, I think there's about close to 85,000 people in Ireland that we hadn't bargained for. Now, with our own housing situation, and it is very relevant that we can't provide housing for our own people, it's an indication that the government they're going to have to move much faster to get modular housing in. And just listening to that on debate earlier on Micah, and the failure to do anything about modular homes here in Donegal, that's beyond my...
Well, that's a planning issue. And Nicholas, you know, like, we knew what our international... we couldn't have necessarily planned for the additional 50,000, 55,000 Ukrainians that are here. But we know what our responsibilities are in relation to, you know, offering international protection to other people from other parts of the country. We probably should have been able to predict that a tightening of the situation in Britain, what kind of an impact that would have on us. But in terms of providing extra hospital care, extra school places, extra GP care, extra accommodation, we're not really talking much, I don't think, about there doesn't seem to have been any, you know, foresight or planning, even though much of this was predictable, Nicholas, some would argue.
Well, it did come on, as John rightly said, so since last February, March, that we have been having an influx of refugees from Ukraine. But as you're saying, is that the problem seems to be with undocumented people. And that, a lot of that is hearsay, but people that come into any country, and particularly to Ireland, they must come in at a focal point. And that is the place where they should be checked out. So if you're a genuine refugee coming from Ukraine, displaced by war, that's no problem. Then there's an onus on, suppose, the Irish government to help those people. But if somebody's coming in undocumented, and I'd like to see any of our crowd going to Australia or Canada or America or myself landing without a passport to see what would happen. So there lies the problem. If those people are allowed through border control, where do they go then?
Yeah, and it's an interesting point, Nicholas, because a lot of this conversation is coming from a report that some people were tearing up their documents on the plane. Now, we have, I think it's 25,000 international protection individuals who aren't from Ukraine, but no one's officially come out and told us how many of those have arrived here without documents. Do you know what I mean? So in that vacuum of no information, the presumption is that they all must throw their passports out the window of the aeroplane once they get on it. But that's clearly not the case. But I don't know the figures. I can't quote or counter-argue because all that stuff seems to be a secret.
Well, I think that both yourself and John Hattonay, we were told 6 months ago in Donegal that there was no more refugees coming from Donegal because our schools, our doctors, our primary care centres were at capacity. So that we weren't able to take it. But since then, there has been an influx of both Ukrainian and others into Donegal. Some of the premises, look, they don't need planning, but they do need fire certs. So if they get a fire cert, but they must be fit for purpose. And look, health and safety must come into this. And you just, if you cram too many people together, there's only one thing that's going to happen, and that there's going to be, you know, there's a few different cultures coming together. It only spells for bother, really. But as you're well aware, Drew Harris was down last Monday week in Lufford, and there's no spike anywhere in the country regarding this of the influx of refugees into Ireland. Most of the people that I have
in terms of no spike in crime, you're saying
there's no spike in crime in any of the parts of it. Obviously, there's going to be some trouble if there's too many people living in the one spot, but I think it's just we have to be very careful of the premises must be fit for purpose for these people to come into Ireland.
So, Maria, we've all sort of identified the problems, the issues, what might be causing it, what might be to come, but we're still not any further advanced, and maybe it's beyond us here on this call to sort of say, well, where do we go from here? Because between people's genuine concerns and agitators, I'm predicting it's only a matter of time before something really quite significant happens in this country.
Yeah, I think, you know, what Nicholas said there is true as well, that when you put loads of people in the services and aren't adequate, that's where we have issues. Because what happens then, and we're seeing it in the health service, for example, the health service are overworked, they're overcrowded, they're underfunded. There is so much going on there for the people that are working on that front line. And they then can't cope daily with what is in front of them. And then we decide, right, well, who's to blame for that? And rather than blaming the people above with the pens and the decision making, we blame the people who are sitting and looking for the services. And when you're then looking and seeing perhaps people from different cultures or people from different areas coming in, and you think that you're more entitled, this is where we have an issue. So I think if we stop fighting with each other on the base of it and started to look from the top down about how can we fix the health service, how can we fix the education service, how can we have to provide. And as the gentleman said there, we've known this isn't a new thing. This hasn't started yesterday. This has been going for a long time. We have the numbers. We know how many have arrived in. We know how many more are coming. And yet we're not seeing very much provision being made from the point of view of making sure that we have accessible services for everybody, you know. So I don't know, when things go wrong, we tend to blame who we feel has caused them to go wrong rather than looking at maybe solutions that could be made.
And John, just in terms of recent arrivals into Letterkenny, for example, my understanding is that there's no prior negotiation with Gardaí about it. I don't believe GPs are contacted they're asked, you know, they're not told if there's any extra capacity or what have you. I'm not sure an audit's done of schools in advance either, if that applies, if there are young people. Do you know, like, basic stuff that you would do to make sure people are well looked after, it doesn't seem to be happening. But is the case so dire in other parts of the world that that's just the way it has to be? I don't know. What is the...
I would imagine that the system at IPAS and at the Department of Social Integration was so overwhelmed with the numbers coming in the early days that they've never even come to terms with it. We probably don't even know officially how many of them have arrived here. We don't know where they're all staying, actually, because we were back in the early days, into July, August, September, I was trying to source out numbers on a weekly basis, and I was getting different figures from all over the place. But then, anecdotally, you were seeing people arrive in Milford that weren't on any list. And that made me wonder, how are these people being looked after? Who's responsible for them? Has it got to a point that we are so overwhelmed, it's better to take them in than leave them in Ukraine where they could get bombed into kingdom come? You have to look at it in different ways. We're always going to have in situations of that kind with 70,000 people. It's never going to be perfect. But when you add into the mix the social media and the kind of conversations that are taking place there, that all Ukrainians should be turned back and sent home, that's absolutely crazy. That's not going to happen. We're a very generous country. We have obligations to the United Nations. We have obligations otherwise as well. But on moral grounds, we have the biggest obligation of all, because for centuries, Irish people emigrated to the free world, and if they'd been turned back at Ellis Island, they would all have died. So you can't have that going on. We have to have a bit more respect for them and a bit more moderation.
Just before we take a break and move on, do any of you have any concerns that on an international level, we're not seeing any efforts to try and come up with a solution to the war in Ukraine? Now, I'm not saying that we should try and convince the Ukrainians to capitulate. I'm not saying that for a second. But what we are seeing instead from the West is them engaging in things that really are likely to see an escalation and to drive more people out of Ukraine. I'm talking about the supplying of weapons and tanks and what have you. And I understand why that is happening. But should there be another channel that we should be aware of, Maria, I'll ask you first, whereby we're trying to come up with some sort of a resolution to this? Because it seems, and I think, dare I quote Boris Johnson, I think he said yesterday in an article, look, we have to admit it here, Europe is at war with Russia. I mean, that's what's happening here. But there seems to be no movement towards any efforts to find peace, Maria. The tens of thousands of... young fellas dying every week is horrendous to me, but...
The problem, I suppose, is as well that who is responsible? Where does the buck stop in a situation like this? Because everyone is responsible to a certain extent. Everybody who's involved, every country has some responsibility, but even that we argue over, you know? So I think, it's so, so difficult to even kind of try to figure out where you could sit down and start to make changes, or who is supposed to sit at that table. You know, the problem with every time you step into a kind of political situation is that with people getting into a room to try and make things better, everybody has their own agenda. Everybody has their own beliefs. Everybody has their own kind of background. So with the best will in the world, you know, they may not agree on things simply because some one person doesn't want to agree with John Joe across the table, you know. So that's communication, that's politics, that's unfortunately the way things are. But I don't know what it is. It's such an unfortunate situation. I can't see it getting any better before it gets worse. And when the people are having to flee their own country because they have no one to care for them there, like, that's bigger than all of us, you know.
Yeah. Nicholas, would you like to see more efforts internationally to try and come up with some sort of a negotiated...
I think Marie put it when everybody gets into the one room, when France and England, or not France, England, Italy, Germany and other countries, and deciding what they're going to do, it's, well, we're filled to capacity. Can you take any more? Regarding sending in tanks, we are, Europe, or certainly Ukraine, is at war, and now with the supply of tanks coming in from different countries, God only knows what way Putin will look at this here, the Russian people, will they look at this here as an interference from other countries, interfering in Ukrainian, which he is saying that it belongs to the motherland. This is far from over, this Ukrainian war, and God only knows what it could escalate into, and maybe in a short few months that we could speak, talking here, we mightn't be talking about refugees at all, we mightn't be talking about something a lot more serious and sinister than what's happening at this present moment in time.
John, quick word from you.
What we're looking at here is, this is a war between America, NATO and Russia for supremacy. In whatever direction it's going to blow, we don't know. There is no hope at this point of any negotiated settlements, because it's all about firing up more tanks, more military and more strength and more power. But they're now in that winter period of quiet where weather conditions are terrible, but the build-up is on there. By the next 6 weeks, a lot of those tanks will have made their way in there. And all that's going to happen is that tens and thousands, hundreds of thousands of young, innocent teenagers on either side of the campaign, and there are two sides to it, they're going to be cannon fodder in the name of international diplomacy. And that's a sad way for what's going on there, because the reality is that it's very likely at this point that at least 500,000 people combined have already lost their lives. And you have to ask, what for?
Nothing at this point. Okay, John, listen, thank you very much for that. Back with more from our guests and your comments as well after the break. Okay, political donations and expenses continue to dominate the news cycle. It's been over a week now. Proper order, or should we be focused on more important issues like we already have been this morning? Shall we go with the news editor, John McAteer? What do you think, John?
We've talked about this a few times and we'll no doubt talk about it again. The whole idea of a standard and public office ethical body was much needed back in the early 2001 when it was founded. It replaced one that was regarded to be much out of date. We had more tribunals of inquiries. We had more corruption scandals. We have to look to the fact that we have this for a very specific reason, and that is to hold those in public office to account. And I suppose, Nicholas, you have to fill in forms every time you fight a local election, and you have to account for every cent that you spend. And it's probably not that easy. You're probably not spending a big fortune. But when it's a big party like Sinn Féin, you're caught there for a couple of thousand euros. They didn't pay for a facility in the centre of Dublin. I'm not too sure how that thing happens, but on the wider scale of that, you've had the Pascal Donoghue thing rumbling on, and it didn't become so much about the fact that it was 234 euro. I don't know how that arrived at, you know, and how he couldn't have cleared that up the very first day that he spoke on the dial, and that it lingered on for another week. And other questions are being thrown into the mix there now. And we had the Damien English issue of the ownership of two houses. All of that feeds into a narrative of a lack of trust in politicians, and it feeds into, is SIPO past its sell-by date insofar as been restructured is concerned. We have been waiting for an electoral commissioner that is not yet appointed. There's a whole lot of things not yet appointed, but the standards in public office legislation, they're probably difficult to manage. But there's no reason for breaking them, because, you know, if you have doubts, you will contact them. There are six officers there. There's the Ombudsman, there's the Comptroller General, there's the Clerk in the of the Dáil in the Senate. There's a retired judge as chair, and there's an ex-senator. And so they should be fit to manage that. But, you know, the year before last, there was almost 50 recommendations put down in the Dáil to help reform the system. They were all rejected. There's a report done on it that's gathering dust. So here we are now at the very start of 2023, and we have to trust in our politicians, because if we don't trust them, who in the hell do we trust them?
Yeah, and Sinn Féin, of course, facing its own civil investigation now over spend on a database. It's had to clarify the records as it relates to a number of issues over a couple of election cycles. Eamon Ryan, I kind of, you know, not sneered, but giggled a little bit when he said, if we start discussing this in the Dáil, if we get everyone to sort of be audited, no other work would get done. I'm paraphrasing him there, but Maria, maybe that is the case. I don't know. Is it a lack of interest in getting things right? Is it a complex? I mean, it shouldn't be beyond parties to get this stuff right, should it?
No. Funny, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but there was one of the journalists in the Irish Times during the week, and she referred to it as a civil war in the Dáil, where basically one side got, you did this, well, you did this, well, you did this. And then the crowd that were throwing the accusations on Monday were then on Wednesday having to answer their own. Look, mistakes can be made. We're all human. Whether it's in politics or business, you can, you know, especially when large numbers, amounts of money, not even large amounts of money, sometimes just your basic VAT returns for the month, receipts can be mislaid, mistakes can be made. However, when mistakes are made and the issue is highlighted and the response is along the lines of, well, we didn't know, or we forgot, or we suddenly recollected, or I was unsure in my recollection, rather than just saying, I made a mistake and I'm wrong, that's where the trust that you mentioned decides to go. I think a lot of the time with, you know, the idea of corruption and different things like that, it's a case of keep going, keep doing it until we get caught out. And then when we get caught out, we just say, oh, oops, you know, and that's to do with the property, all the different issues that have come up in the last few months, everything that has come to light between the public expenditure, the posters. I mean, the van commercial value suddenly appearing as €434.20. Like, where did that even come from? But all of a sudden it is, oops, our bad, you know. But there's never I'm sorry. There's never an apology. There's never a hands up that we shouldn't have done that. So there's a fine line between human error and purposely and happily making these decisions, assuming you're not going to get called out. And then when you do get caught or called out, then saying, well, I did this, but you did that. And that's where we then, as the public, sit and watching this through the social media, through the newspapers, through the news reports, that's where you start to wonder, who can you trust? And as you said there, if we can't trust the people who are leading us.
And I think it's not just in this area, it's absolutely everything in this country that has fallen into a fallacy of relative privation. There's actually a name of it. Whereas our argument about something being okay is that it's not as bad as another thing.
That's it.
And it's whether it's to do with this, it's whether to do with housing, it's whether to do with immigration. The whole, everything is just this fallacy of relative privation. Nicholas, your views on this topic?
Well, certainly it dominated the media for the past week with Pascal Donoghue. But I think it's very important. Anybody in public office is responsible and should be accountable for their actions. And if a mistake was made, John did say that councillors fill in their forms after election and before the 31st of January every year. We have to declare our interest. Do we own any property? Do we have development land? Are we involved with county council, hiring and machinery? Have we shares in businesses? We're asked our financial, everything, probably bar our bank statements, donations, expenses, whatever. So I think it's very, very important. Now, for the past 28 years, I filled in that form to the best of my ability, and I think every other councillor done it. That have I made a mistake in it? I don't think I did. But if I was notified of a mistake, I would certainly go and rectify it immediately. Now, most councillors fill in their own forms. I know some parties fill in all councillors' forms, and I think that's a bad idea, because there's a scapegoat there. I didn't fill in that form. At least if I filled in my form, I'm responsible for it and I should be accountable for it. So I would agree that it did dominate. I actually happened, you couldn't believe it, I happened to be in the Dáil when the debate was going on, and I was sitting above the Pascal Donoghue listening in, and it was, suppose if some of the TDs knew what was coming down the next day, it mightn't have been as verbal, but it was pretty hectic there for a while. But look, the amount of money is irrespective of what the amount of money it was, it should have been ratified in 2016 and 2020. That's my opinion of it. Took too long. Standards and Public Office, SIPO was there. They don't have an awful lot of power, or if they do have it, they certainly do not show it.
And people want immediate results now. I think the time frames and 2-3 years for things to come to light. Finally, before we take one more quick break.
Go ahead, of course, Nicholas. Maria said something. Small things that are overlooked then become the norm. And then after, say, it's not as bad as that boy. But it doesn't really matter. You must be responsible and you have to get out.
The only problem I think we have, Maria, and I could be wrong, maybe this is something from within inside my own head coming out, but I'm not sure it benefits anyone really, because I think most of the public might go, well, sure, what do you expect? Do you know what I mean? I don't think people go all of a sudden, yes, that's that problem resolved right now. It's just like more a shrug of the shoulders, and that's why we have 60% of people bother voting.
Yeah, there's definitely an apathy and a complacency that comes with these things happening over and over and over again. And as you said, oh, here we go again, you know, and then one event happens, and because something similar has happened so many times, it just becomes the norm. And then we just shrug our shoulders and go, ah, well. But yes, as you said, Nicholas, people need to be responsible for their actions, and that's just it.
It also affects the general public in a very particular way as well, is that many people like to be affiliated to different parties. They like to be out and about, putting up posters, canvassing, and doing all the work that you do around election. In recent elections, as Nicholas, you will see, there's a reluctance of a younger generation to become very much involved in the whole political agenda, and there aren't enough young people out there. But the support base for political parties seems to have diminished enormously for election campaigns, and these kind of messages coming out here does not help, because at what point does something become commercial as opposed to being a voluntary thing? At the last election, there was about 7.3 million spent by about 530 candidates or thereabouts. Now, that every last cent of that has got to be accounted for, every last meeting. What was corporate? What wasn't? What was donations? It's a pretty grey area when you look at it there. And it's from, I think the biggest losers here will be people will not want to get involved here, because if you're driving one of them white vans for commercial purposes, let you be a builder or a painter or something like that, if that is seen out, everybody's going to wonder how much are you getting for the evening.
You pose a really interesting question. I just wonder how many of teenagers now 13 to 19 will be engaged in politics on any level in not maybe this election cycle, but the next or the one after that. What's engaging them? What's bringing them in? What's hooking them?
They'll talk about politics right enough. They're pretty clued into politics. Mm-hmm. There's no two ways about that. But the participation at local level, we have it coming up in the local elections a year from May. It's going to be interesting to see, because candidates and councillors and people seeking re-election, they need the support of their community. They've got to get out and canvass. They can't canvass every door themselves. But will people now be afraid to be seen out canvassing with them? And what will the candidates think? You know, every candidate that has put in returns this last two or three elections will now be looking over their shoulders to see, did we do that right? Or do we owe the state some service by giving back another 30 or 40 euro?
Nicholas,
I don't know where it's going.
Are you looking forward to the next council elections?
Well, certainly, Greg. Why wouldn't I be? I love it. I love the canvas. I love going out and meeting people. It's probably sometimes, since COVID, is only the time you will get to meet an awful lot of people since the last election. I would agree with John, there's still an awful lot of people, youth out there, that have an interest in it. But, you know, it's up to yourselves, and there's an onus on media.
But will they, people. And you can make that point, sorry, but yes, I know. Thankfully, we get opportunities to chat to them on this programme, but will they, those with an interest in politics now, the teenagers we're talking of, will they be engaging with political parties, you know what I mean, in canvassing or in supporting or running for elections. That's kind of, I mean, they're there, but maybe they know enough that they might go, you know what, I don't want any part of that.
No, well, there's a possibility that the party faithful, as John said, might be slipping off, and it's a botheration, and it's, I haven't got the time. But there's still a lot of interest at election time.
Okie doke, thanks. Yeah, go ahead, John.
But you can't have politics, Nicholas, without having the grassroots support. And you have to have a fair circle of support around you to get elected, even at council level. It's pretty competitive, you know. And I'm sure up on Inishowen, with people like yourselves having to get out on the doorsteps, you're going to be hit with all this stuff and confidence and trust in politicians, given that you have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with it. Yeah. And I mean, you're on the road long enough now to know that it's never going to be an easy task to get re-elected. Mm. But now that you've opened your campaign on Highland Radio this morning, you're let us wish you
Maria,
well.
Maria, they're looking for us young ones to get involved in politics. What do you think, should we?
I think I'd get in trouble, Jack Craig.
We
get involved in a very different way because we predict the future and hope that it'll happen.
Yes, and then make many predictions so one might be correct. Okay, take care. Don't take care. Don't go anywhere. Take a breath there. We'll be back with more after this quick break. Okay, a caller says, my doorstep is a politician-free zone. I wonder, will there be more of that? I don't know.
I would hope not, because, you know, your local politician is your main conduit with everything else in the country. And if you can't have a relationship with your own local councillor as a starting point, then you're onto a loser. Because I've been involved in politics over the years, writing about politics, out canvassing, spending money, probably spending away above the limits on election campaigns with various candidates. But like at the end of the day, your local politician to me is more important than the people we send up to the authorities, because they're the first step on the ladder of democracy.
A caller says, Ireland's position in the war is a disgrace. Can we now say we are not a neutral country? We are complicit in murder and should be striving for peace negotiations if we learn nothing from our own war. Well, we're not politically a neutral a country. That's a fallacy, really. And really dismayed to hear Nicholas parroting the tropes that undocumented people are coming into the country. I mean, there are a concern that some of them are undocumented. The majority are. Everyone is, the name is logged, their ID checked, they're fingerprinted, and there is a level of vetting that goes on. But, I mean, clearly there are some that are coming in that don't have their documents with them. I presume that small group is who you're talking of, Nicholas.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Okay. How do you vet refugees, their homeland at war or where they've been persecuted from, and do not want them to know where they are, as their relatives may be further punished? Never mind their administration systems that are probably at a lower level than here, and the corruption of services and counterfeiting, rehealth service and other service. Our government, we repeatedly elect with the ruling permanent government of civil servants, are to blame for lack of planning and project management, not the asylum seekers, refugees and victims of war. I just think it'd be really helpful if someone from government or whomever's responsible outlines clearly what level of vetting is being done and how that is all being dealt with. It's back in the news again this morning. I'm not stoked about it, to be honest with you. Back in the front pages today. Enoch Burke back at school. If he doesn't, vacate the court order, he's going to face fines of €700 per day. I don't think he'll have any problem paying that, because I imagine there'll be some sort of a fund set up to support him in that regard. I think at this point, is it maybe a case that those who maybe agreed with Enoch Burke, with him continuing to turn up the school, maybe their support is wavering? I don't know. Maria, what's your take on this?
Oh, I have a lot of take on this. I have a huge amount of sympathy for the staff and students and school community at the school, at Wilson Hospital School. And, you know, I don't know what his point is at this point. I don't know what it is he thinks he is going to achieve. The man is more than entitled to his opinion. He is more than entitled to his religious belief. But those opinions and beliefs are not fact or are not truth for everybody. And I think when you start to mix up the idea of rebelling against things and you mix that up with the idea of imposing your opinions on people, that's where we've got to this situation, because he seems to think that he's standing up for some greater good. He seems to think that he is going to change the world.
But he does seem to... only words I've heard from him is him referencing his own personal beliefs. Like, I don't see him... I haven't heard him make wider comments about a pushback against transgenderism as such. Like, I have only, in fairness to him, I have only heard him talk of his own personal
beliefs. And he's more than entitled to those beliefs. But when his beliefs have turned into a media circus, which is in fact impacting Leaving Cert, Junior Cert students and a staff going into their work every day, the principals, the board of management, all these people have suddenly become, their names have been fired about in the media for doing their jobs. I'm sorry, I'm a teacher, guys, and I have massive issues with the fact that when you have been dismissed from your job, you do not continue to turn up at your workplace. It doesn't matter what you teach or what you work in. So there are ways and means to stand up for yourself. And again, as I say, I don't agree with his opinions, but I don't have to agree with his opinions. They are his opinions. Mm-hmm. I have my opinions. Everybody's entitled to their opinion, but my opinion is not your truth. And for me to continuously impose my right to have an opinion about something by impacting so many people, that's not right.
But in a way, too, his opinion, he could maintain his opinion but still respect the rights of the student in question. I mean, he wasn't being invited to live with them or to...
I think it's
how they referenced him. But I mean, as I say, there are competing rights here. There are other people's rights at play here, presumably, Maria.
The other thing, Greg, it's gone past the student in particular. I mean, my sympathies go to that child. You know, it's gone past that. As a teacher, when you sign a contract to work in a school, you say that you agree that you're going to uphold the ethos of that building and of that community and of that school. It's part of your job. So no one's asking you to agree with absolutely everything that is said. As a teacher, I have dealt with things over the last 21 years that I don't understand fully. I've seen shifts in young people, and young people are phenomenal. And I will, till the day I die, I will say that young people are brilliant. And we could learn so much from them, and we can learn so much. And it's a privilege to get to work with young people and to see the progression and the innovation that comes from them. Society in 20 years' time is going to be dealt with and run by the young people who are in our schools at the minute. And it's interesting that we brought up the idea of young people going into politics this morning. They're brilliant, and we should listen to them. That does not mean that everything they say is right, because obviously there's a fine line between being very passionate about a cause and having the common sense and experience to know that the world is a different place. But there is absolutely professionalism here that has to be questioned as well. If you are a teacher, you are an educator, your job and your only job apart from to teach the subject is to provide a safe environment for children.
Okay.
And that's it.
John McAteer, I'm not really quite sure what point Mr. Burke is making at this point. And I think that was kind of referenced in the court ruling. I also do believe that there is, I don't know how large it is, but there's a considerable amount of people out there who may not be speaking publicly that would have sympathies, at least to his point of view. What's your take on it all, John?
Maria made 2 points there about an educator and about a public servant. The day that you sign up to become a public servant, it's not a big onerous task. Educating children is what you're trained to do. The upset to that school, to the whole ethos of the school, the pupils, the teachers, and the publicity that is attracted. He has lost his case. He can't be allowed to drag a horse and cart through the whole regulations of education. Enoch Burke is at a point now where he's going to be fined €700 a day. That's going to go beyond that. He's back in court, I think, on the 14th of February. That €700 a day will be a big deterrent if it's doubled and if it's trebled. He probably will end back in prison again. He may well become a prisoner of his own conscience, which is not something you want people to do. But like at the end of the day, the work in the schools and the education of the children, he's in breach of all that. He's in breach of high court order and turning up at the school. And it's just a very, very sad situation.
Are the media taking a hand at this stage in constantly turning up with their cameras and photographers?
I would have to say so.
Because, I mean, we also need to know at this point, like, you know, where is he at? You know, I'm not saying there's any issues there with him, but I just think to some extent the media are turning up to see what he does next. If you listen to the tone of the conversation, they're kind of taking a hand a bit in some of their private remarks, not necessarily the published. But go ahead,
Berkshire,
John.
The Berkshire are a very focused family. They have a one-dimensional way of looking at things. You can't argue with that. We're living in a democracy. But the greater order is that you cannot continually disobey the orders of the public service that has been good enough to give you a job. The school and the teaching and the children's days has to go on. Teachers have to be there, and they need an atmosphere that doesn't have the media and doesn't have somebody like it's going to be that like it is the talk of the school, it's the talk of the country. And as I say, there's too many pictures of them on the front pages of the Red Tops. I don't know where the end of this is going to be. They don't want to put him back in prison because he's going to stay there for until he's removed. He has already been released from prison despite the fact that he didn't purge his contempt, but they felt that he had served enough time in jail to have effectively done so. He's not going to purge his contempt, and he has the backing of his own family and probably a small cohort of other people around him. And they'll need to step back and think to themselves, whose good are we serving here? Is it our own personal good, or is it those of whom we're supposed to serve? And like we're trained for our profession, and he's probably a very good teacher.
Right.
But sadly, that's where it now is.
To do that trade either here or anywhere, actually, with his convictions. Last brief word to you, Nicholas, if you don't mind.
I think, obviously, he's a man of principles. He believes in his Christian beliefs, and he's entitled to those. But when he turns a spotlight back onto his profession, onto the school, and onto the pupils of that school, I think that's where it falls down on him. I'm sure there are that pupil now will be well known throughout the land. Does he want that to happen to him? Are there other children in the same position, or maybe find it difficult through teenage years? And I think it's very, very unfair of what he's doing. But she's a teacher. She was in there, tried to do her job. We're not saying he's a bad teacher. We're not saying anything. We don't know. But all we're saying is what he's doing is certainly detrimental for the school and the pupils.
Nicholas Crossan, councillor, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. Take care of yourself. John McAteer, great to have you on the show as always. Look after yourself. Bye bye. And last but not least, Maria Rush, thank you for your time. Have a lovely day and great weekend too.
You too.
Thank you so very much indeed.